This is Rabbi Ethan Tucker of Mechon Hadar. Vayishlach Yisrael et yemino, vayashet al rosh Ephraim vehu hatzair, ve'et smolo al rosh Menashe. Uniformity and diversity, left-handedness and halacha. Parashat Vayechi 57:76. This week's Torah reading contains a dramatic scene. Yaakov, nearing the end of his life, receives his two Egyptian-born grandsons in order to give them a blessing. The older one, Menashe, and the younger one, Ephraim, are brought by their father, Yosef, to Yaakov's deathbed. Yosef guides Menashe to stand near Yaakov's right hand, and Ephraim near his left. The right hand, signifying power and dominance, is the appropriate vehicle with which to bless a firstborn. Ephraim will also receive a blessing, but of the non-dominant sort, appropriate for a younger son. In a shocking turn of events, Yaakov crosses his hands, placing his right on Ephraim's head and left on Menashe's. When Yosef objects and tries to forcibly reverse his father's arms, Yaakov stays the course. Yadati, Bani, Yadati. I know, my son, I know. Don't worry. They will both achieve greatness, but the younger brother will be the greater of the two. The crossed hands seal the deal, and the Jewish parents for all time have blessed their sons with the phrase, Yisimcha Elohim ke Ephraim v'chimnashe, may God make you like Ephraim and Menashe, giving Ephraim precedence over Menashe. The entire plot line here is dependent on the significant role of the right hand, clearly connected to the right hand's dominance in most human beings. But was Yaakov himself right-handed? Or would the story have played out the same way had he been a lefty? Does right-handedness encode the more abstract concept of dominance? Or does it become a standard symbol of power for all people just because most people are righties? I want to use the opportunity afforded by this story to engage what I think is an important area of Jewish legal discourse, halacha's treatment of left-handed people. This week's longer essay explores a range of sources that discuss the proper behaviors of left-handed people in various rituals. At the heart of these texts and the debates surrounding them is an implicitly shared question. When do we understand the law to demand uniformity, even at the price of repressing difference and exclusion? When do we understand the law to refract itself through the lens of human diversity? Uniformity is the lifeblood, and in some ways the raison d'etre of community. People form community in order to create something in common, something that will bind them together, join them together for some shared purpose. This inevitably requires the submission of the individual to the whole, the suppression of various idiosyncratic needs and forms of expression into more homogenized and generalized practices and ways of being. Shared dress, language, and rituals all aim to channel potentially untrammeled human creativity and diversity into unified channels. The uniformity that results is a prerequisite for any meaningful collective identity and reality. And yet, individual human beings are different from one another in so many ways. On a pragmatic level, a community that demands too much uniformity may not ultimately be able to sustain their loyalty without oppression and violence. More idealistically, communities that crush the diversity of their individuals will deprive themselves of a unique set of talents and gifts that might otherwise enrich the collective. To the extent that an excessive embrace of diversity threatens to dissolve community or render it exceedingly thin and meaningless, excessive uniformity threatens to deaden community or render it tyrannical. And so the work of communities is always to balance these two values of uniformity and diversity. The former creates and sustains the group, the latter makes it bearable and vivifying for a range of people to live within it. From a religious perspective, yet another concern is at work, determining exactly when God wants and expects each of these values to trump when they are in conflict. God's law, and humans' interpretation of it, clearly demands a great deal of uniformity in any religious system, and the Torah is no exception. The Torah expects all Jews to refrain from forbidden activity on the same day of the week, and more broadly demands adherence to a shared festival calendar. It demands that Jewish farmers in the land of Israel let their lands lie fallow in synchronicity every 7 years, and forbids those farmers, irrespective of their individual preferences, from planting certain crops in proximity to one another. We could go on and on. Nearly all aspects of religious law involve restricting freedom and channeling potentially diverse energies seeking spirituality and meaning into a shared commanding framework. Halakha's treatment of lefties grapples with the same issues, and a variety of interesting positions are staked out. In particular, I identify five models for dealing with handedness that we find in halachic sources. The first is exclusion. In this model, the need for right-handed uniformity and the costs of left-handedness are so strong that lefties simply cannot be included at all. This model is used to disqualify left-handed kohanim from serving in the temple, where consistent choreography and competence are at a premium, and where the costs of excluding people from a highly elitist activity are low. A second model is what I'll call passing. The need for right-handed uniformity is strong, but the wholesale exclusion of left-handed people is extreme or unnecessary. Lefties are simply expected to conform to right-handed expectations, and their left-handedness is rendered invisible. The Itur takes this approach around lulav and etrog. The Talmud states that the lulav should be taken in the right hand and the etrog in the left. Itur says that this prescription applies to lefties as well, understanding the value of coordinated aesthetics to be high and feeling that maintaining this essentially ceremonial requirement for all people does not really distort the core meaning of the mitzvah for those whose hands are wired differently. The third model is what I'll call the double burden model. In this one, lefties are indeed different, and their distinctive reality must be taken into account. They can't simply be treated like righties. That said, the dominant paradigm of right-handedness is so significant that lefties must accommodate it as well and adhere to its standards. This creates a double burden for lefties, who must account both for their own difference as well as for the needs and standards of the majority. This view is manifested in the Talmud by one sage's approach to writing on Shabbat. He posits that while righties only violate the biblical ban on writing by doing so with their dominant right hand, lefties are liable for writing with either hand, the left on account of its dominance for them, and the right on account of it being the way most writing is done. A fourth model is what I'll call the mirror image model. In this model, the costs of uniformity are high, as are the benefits of embracing diversity. Righties and lefties are allowed to inhabit mirror image realities, each acting out the shared value of dominance as refracted through diverse bodily states. Neither may deviate from the prescribed path, which is grounded in inherent handedness. This model is most prominently on display in the reigning position on how to put on tefillin. Righties have a non-negotiable requirement to put tefillin on the left arm, whereas lefties must place it on the right. The categories of right and left are just conventional expressions of the terms dominant and non-dominant, and those values apply equally but divergently to a diverse human reality. Finally, the fifth model is what I'll call deconstruction. In this model, the presence of lefties and righties in the world destabilizes our very notion of handed preferences making sense at all, leading to a rejection of even a mirror image model. A deep internalization of the fact that lefties and righties do things in different ways leads to a conviction that it does not really matter what hand one uses, and all are free to choose based on personal comfort or preference. This approach is generally absent from halakha and antithetical to an ethos of direction and obligation. However, there is perhaps a hint of it in the plain sense of the Mishnah's take on Shabbat violation and writing. Unlike the sage we cited above, the Mishnah rejects the notion that handedness matters in the context of writing on Shabbat at all, arguing instead that consequential results, rather than dominance, should define the parameters of the forbidden labor of writing. As long as someone has written something with their hand, they have committed a core biblical violation of Shabbat. And in that sense, this model can surface in halachic discussion when someone argues that a factor like handedness is in fact a proxy for another concern, and that that concern is irrelevant as a factor in a contemporary context. That approach will, of course, only be viable if there's no ongoing coherence whatsoever to the handed bias evident in earlier texts. In our specific example, nothing of this sort survives. Perhaps the neatest example of these models collected all in one place can be found in the example of chalitza, the ritual designed to release a leveret bond that has formed between a man and his childless dead brother's wife. Dvarim prescribes that the widow must remove the shoe from her brother-in-law's foot as part of this ritual. Mishnah Yevamot rules that this must be done with the right foot, and if done with the left foot, the act is invalid and the bond has not been broken. The Talmud does not address the question of how to deal with a left-footed man. Does the ritual look any different for him based on his atypical dominance? That exercise is left for medieval authorities, who generate all the possibilities. First, Ramban rules that left-footed men cannot release their sisters-in-law from the levered bond at all. Right-footedness is essential for this ritual, and these men essentially lack a proper right foot. Like the priests in the temple, they cannot perform this ritual. The woman must either marry him or remain bound to him for life. Sefer Mitzvot Gadol rules that lefties act like righties, and the shoe is removed from the right foot, as it would be in any other case, the model of passing. A third view, cited in the Ravya, required left-footed levers to have shoes removed from both feet to accommodate both uniformity and diversity, playing out the double burden model. The Ravya himself rules that left-footed levers have the shoe removed from the left foot, just as we reverse the application of the mitzvah of tefillin, playing out the mirror image model. And then there is a faint echo of the deconstructionist approach in Rabbi Eliezer's view in the Mishnah. Whereas the Mishnah states that chalitza must be done with the right foot, and if done with the left foot, it is invalid, Rabbi Eliezer validates chalitza on the left foot as well. This is obviously meant as a general pronouncement, meant to apply to right-footed men as well. And this suggests that he rejected the notion that handedness mattered at all in this mitzvah, footedness more precisely, contrary to the majority view in the Mishnah. But once the Mishnah's preference for the right foot comes to the fore, this alternate view dies and is never revived. I've laid out these models here in order to clarify the various values at stake when having these discussions, but not in order to encourage adopting one model or the other across the board. It's silly and impossible to have a conceptual a priori approach to balancing uniformity and diversity when it comes to handedness. In fact, one of the most interesting aspects of this topic is that the various models here are adopted simultaneously by various religious authorities. Indeed, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, seems to have held that left-handed priests are entirely excluded from the temple, all people are supposed to carry the lulav in their right hand, left-footed men have chalitza performed on both feet, and left-handed people wear tefillin on the right arm, a hybrid of four of the different five models that I've laid out. Now, broadly speaking, I think we can say that it's wise to be cautious and hesitant about the deconstructionist model when trying to accommodate diversity. It can flirt with antinomianism and potentially unwisely eliminate entire traditions that may still be applicable to at least a part of the population. And we should, in my view, also often give special attention to the mirror image model, which can open up the possibility for the ongoing vitality of a surface application of the Torah's mitzvot to the majority, even as it refuses to ignore the incredible variation in God's world. This model reminds us that it is possible to insist that it is wrong for righties to wear tefillin on their right arm, while insisting that this is precisely what lefties must do. Context does and must drive all of these discussions. The goal is not to come up with a conceptual model of balancing uniformity and diversity and then to apply it everywhere. Rather, the goal is to reflect on the fact that any of these models is plausible, and therefore the choice to apply any of them anywhere is the product of attempting to understand God's will, the purpose of the mitzvah at hand, the facts that surround us, and to make a right judgment. Our discussion of uniformity and diversity should remind us that the complexity of both mitzvot and the world they are applied to call for vigilant and careful application of God's eternal will to diverse people and situations. It is unreasonable to expect unanimity on how to do that, but it is appropriate to expect consciousness of what is at stake, the underlying values animating various choices, and humility that other interpretive paths might always have been taken.